Hello.
And welcome back to This Is Not
a History
Lecture.
Oh man, oh man.
We are recording early for y'all, which means that...
Actually, no, this one will be like pretty normal, but the...
Oh, you're right.
We're doing a double today, so the one you hear for next week, we're also recording today, so that one will be a little bit early.
Yeah. So that means that for us, today is Sunday, February 4th. It is nice outside, but that also marks... 3 years.
3 years tomorrow.
That we've been doing this.
That this has not been a history lecture.
And it makes me want to cry, scream, and all of the above. Because
we started this in grad school.
I know. I feel old now.
And now we both have real jobs.
Ew.
Isn't that gross?
That is gross. But regardless, that means you'll be hearing this on February
6th. Yes.
And I, today, will be talking about... the World's Columbian Expedition, the Chicago World Fair.
No way!
Yes.
Oh my god!
I know, that's why I was like so scared that you'd done
okay,
it.
Okay, you said, I was so nervous that I had done it already, and I was like, this has got to be good, whatever it is,
I was like,
for her to be this
that,
nervous.
I was like, it's got to be something yeah. that Cal would have done, and I had to check twice on our list to make sure.
Oh my god, no, I have not done it, but I have wanted to do it, and I'm so glad you're doing it, because that means I just get to listen.
So that's what I'm talking about today. What are you
going to
be talking about?
So I am doing a little bio. It is February, it's the first episode of February, so I'm going to be doing a bio on a really, really, really interesting man named Gordon Parks.
I don't know that name at all.
Who I think you will really enjoy, and I really enjoyed hearing about him.
Huh.
So if you want to learn about either or both of those topics, stick around to find out. Why?
This is not a history lecture with Kat and Kaylee.
All right, we are back.
I'm apologizing for that little ooh.
Special. She was just excited.
I was really excited. I was going to say why, but then my brain was like, ooh.
It's okay. It's a good day. It's a good day here. This is not a history lecture.
We're in there.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Man, now we laughed really hard the second we ended that recording, so I'm like drying my eyes right now.
Yeah. Yeah, we're doing great. We're doing great. If this gives you any idea of what kind of episode it's going to be today,
yeah,
it's going to be a great one.
Which is going to be important because there's some like, I mean, the Chicago World's Fair is really awesome, but also has some like really
not
dark,
good parts of it at
stuff.
All. Yeah.
So, and we're going to be talking about all of the parts of it today.
Yeah, so let's do it. Let's go.
Right
yeah.
in. I'm ready. Okay. So, if you don't want to listen to my section, that's okay. But I'll give you a quick little summary to help you decide whether you want to or not. The Chicago World Fair, sometimes known as, but officially named, the World's Columbian Expedition.
Mm-hmm.
It was this huge... event hosted in Chicago, Illinois in 1893 as a kind of growing trend of exhibition projects that the world was seeing pop up here and there. Kind of supposed to be kind of showcases of culture and history and progress as well and inventions and what was going on in the rest of the world at that point. Think of it as like what would now be, I guess, like a social media convention if like every major influencer from like over America, but like not just influencers but like tech CEOs and like the top of everyone's field was just like in one place.
It was basically like a big bragging.
Yeah
Look at all the things we've accomplished.
And who loves to brag as much as America?
Exactly.
Yeah.
No one.
Yeah. So, yes, let's scroll back to 1893, not to be confused with the Chicago World's Fair that happened in the 1930s. That one was better known as the Century of Progress, and it was kind of like it was an exhibition as well, but the one that really, like, pops to everyone's mind is the Columbian Expedition in 1893. So, we also have to consider the context of the world at this point, especially the U.S. This was aimed for Americans, but it was not solely visited by Americans. Industrialism has radically changed the world. And I'll get into the details, like specific cultural details in a minute, but just go into it with that mindset that there's a lot happening. This is hitting the Gilded Age. America, I mean, namely... has just seen the Civil War end not that long ago, and they're still dealing with those repercussions. It's a decade or so. But this was not the first big fair or exhibition in America. The Philadelphia Centennial Exposition in 1876, so no, like the year after the Civil War ended, essentially, had been a huge success.
Whoa.
Sorry, am I off again? My numbers.
By about a decade, yeah.
Sorry. My numbers are off. I can't do numbers.
It's like middle of Reconstruction.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Like literally I'll look at numbers and they move around on me, so I can't I should not be asked to gauge time.
That's why there's two of us, so we can be like, hold on.
Nope. Oh, try again. 76, not 67.
Yep.
There we go.
Yep.
There's my net. Sorry.
That's why you did that.
The Philadelphia Centennial was 1876. There we go. So it had been pretty successful in attendance, but there was like not a big financial return on that one. And it left a lot of people thinking, like, is this a sustainable practice to have these exhibitions? Like, is it worth it in popularity? But again, this is the Gilded Age when we do things to do them.
Yes. Yeah. For the
awe and shock.
Yeah. For the pomp and circumstance. Mm-hmm. For the, yes. Yeah.
I mean, we've started, like, industrialism has, in a way, allowed us to do things that, like, to reinvent classical ideals and improve them enough to make things grand. Like, think like Brooklyn Bridge or, not Brooklyn Bridge. Brooklyn Bridge.
Yeah.
That was the late 1800s.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Like, engineering and technology and stuff has allowed us to get to that
point. Well, it's also, like, a big part. It's also, like, look at what we can do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the reason why there's a replica of the Parthenon in Nashville is because of the World's Fair that was held there. And it was actually part of a whole complex of, like, world wonders that they just built
because
that event.
Yeah.
And they were never meant to last. And then it was only until later when they were like, wait, we actually want the Parthenon at least to last. And that's why it's still standing.
Yeah.
But it was a whole complex of, like, all reconstructions of the world's wonders just because they could.
And that happened here. There were some buildings that they're like, oh, we should probably, like, put effort into, like, maintaining this. This is actually, like, way better than we thought. There's some buildings that they were like, hey, we should, like, actually put marble on this and actually make it what it looks like. And, like, you know, so there is a lot of that going on. But that Philadelphia Centennial Exposition not only sets the groundwork for, like, oh, we could have these in America as well, because there was a very popular one in, I believe it was Britain, in, like, a couple decades before.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think you're right.
It was a big... Yeah. It was named, like, the glass something.
I know exactly. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
But they take not only the cue of having an exposition, but the style. The one in Philadelphia had used a large garden connecting a bunch of other buildings together. And they replicate that kind of space here. Lots of different buildings where you go to seek out according to that building, rather than like, oh, this is one convention center, walk around in this huge building for like hours and we'll just, you'll eventually find what you're looking for. Kind of like how, I'm trying to think of an equivalent. Maybe like MoMA in New York.
Or like the Louvre.
Oh, the Louvre. The Louvre is a great example. Yeah. You can go into one building in a huge place and see everything together, or you can go to the Smithsonian's where it's broken up by a building, where you have like Air and Space or African-American history and culture. Like, so they use that kind of like breakage system to lay out a multitude of buildings.
Mm-hmm.
The planning for this was done to mark 400 years of American history, notably colonized American history, I would like to point out. Obviously, it was indigenous people have been here much longer than 400 years, but it comes up on Columbus's voyage of marking a 400 year anniversary. This homage was kind of kept in mind with this design, that landscaping and the construction of everything. There was a reflecting pool laid down the center of the park venue that was supposed to represent like the oceans that were crossed and the strides. And of course Columbus thought he was going to the Indies, so like, you know, whatever. But that's another day. That's another rant for another day. We've been on that rant before. And it became a highly competitive competition, I guess is the right word, for cities that were trying to get this event awarded to them.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the Super Bowl. It's it's a huge economic driving force, and especially something this huge where people are coming from around the world. So
we have cities, the main four contenders ended up being St. Louis, Mm-hmm. New York City, DC, and Chicago. And they're fighting like tooth and nail. They're mm-hmm. bringing like bids to the table. They're like, hey, we yeah. can do this. We've got this. But no, mm-hmm. I've got this. Chicago wins out. They had $10 million of funding guaranteed on their side, which is helpful. But that wasn't all handed by the city. Each of these bids for each of these cities were backed by individual contributors. You know, the richest of the rich. And it helps that Chicago is also a huge intersection of railroads.
Mm-hmm.
So people could get there from anywhere if they make a few connections. Mm-hmm. And it's a little further west. So it's a little more accessible to people who have, you know,
yeah.
moved out that way and are looking at their expenses for the trip, et cetera, et cetera.
It's also a huge industry town.
Yes, huge yeah. industry town. It's also easier to build something like this in Chicago than New York that's already like
built out
yeah. and would have to be kind of constricted to an area. There was a lot of land that could be in Chicago that could be manipulated and altered to what they need. We're talking like the planning, like those wealthy benefactors, those who are pushing for New York, we're looking at people, this is the Gilded Age, like J.P. Morgan, mm-hmm. Vanderbilt, mm-hmm. Astors. But those were all vying for New York. They raised like $15 million if it was going to be held there, which is notably more than the $10 million Chicago guaranteed. But in this huge competition, it was eventually the recipient of the Chicago bid was eventually aided in large part by Gustavus Swift or people like Cyrus McCormick who were vying for it to be held in Chicago. Their real ace in the hole was Lyman Gage. He got involved and he was, I guess he just proved his prowess as a Chicago banker. He proved that he could raise $1 million within a day. Like,
Damn.
And he essentially secured it for Chicago.
Wow.
But we are also, we have to consider what's going on in not just the U.S., but Chicago at this time. If mm-hmm. you don't know much about Chicago history, understandable if you don't live there. When I visited a few years ago for my dad's business thing, I had never realized how much of Chicago was lost to the fire.
Like, basically all of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was in 1871, the Great Chicago Fire. Mm-hmm. It left over 100,000 people homeless and killed over 300 people.
Yep.
Like, it drove everyone out of Chicago. It destroyed over 3 square miles of the entire city. Like, prove that, A, you can come back from that shows that you are a kind of resilience, but you also have all that land and that prospect ahead
I mean,
of you.
Also, like, think of what this does for the morale of mm-hmm. Chicagoans. Like, this happened in their lifetimes. And to see them go from absolute destruction and decimation mm-hmm. to literally a world's fair
mm-hmm.
in 20 years time, like, that would do so much to, like, oh my god, we're gonna be okay, you know, like,
and it's a huge boon for America to be like, hey, look at us, we don't stay down for long, mm-hmm. look what we can do.
That's a good point too.
But they've got a lot of land freed up then and unrestricted because, like,
and they've got to build something. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So Chicago, particularly this plot that is now a lot of Jackson Park, if you go to Chicago. In total, it was almost 700 acres near the lake.
Yeah. Wow. Like, wow.
It's a lot of space.
Wow, yeah.
And it's crazy to think that the World's Fair, like, you could, it makes me think of people who visit, like, the Louvre.
Mm-hmm.
How you can go for, like, a week and spend, like, less than, like, a minute at every painting and you still won't make it to the Louvre.
Yeah, it's like you go on vacation to go to the Louvre.
Yeah. Yeah. And so this was going to obviously be an exposition that was not like, oh, we'll stop by for the day. This would take days, hours. Yeah. And if you were like a true devotee, you could be there for weeks doing everything.
Wow.
Depending on how much time you want to spend at it. Me, the museum girl who likes to, like, literally read every single, like, oh, I would have died and gone to heaven. So the popularity and attention that this is going to bring to Chicago is almost unmatched. Mm-hmm. The landscaping alone has its own designer named Frederick Olmsted. That's how much effort was going to go into this. Not just conceptual planning of, like, oh, we need a fountain. Like, there was just a head landscaper who spent, like, a year or so just, like, how do we landscape this? How do we build this? How do we make this, like, aesthetic?
Yeah.
It started in the planning itself early in the 1890s as part of this shift. And I'll have to talk about this a couple of times because, like, this is also the generation of, like, labor strikes.
Mm-hmm.
The Gilded Age has a lot of growth, but on that, like, again, gilded side of things, there is industrialization, which is not mm-hmm. always a pretty thing.
I mean, you don't get wealth disparity like that for nothing, mm-hmm. as we are seeing.
And like you said, Chicago is a city of industry,
yep.
which means there's workers here. And there's a lot of them here. And the bigwigs of the world, including those big fundraisers, but also the government and the people doing this who are trying to create this sense of pride and unity, are well aware that this divide exists, mm-hmm. that this thing has to be remedied and addressed. So in a way, this fair was also supposed to be a way for, like, oh yes, everyone should come together to see our progress. Everyone, there will be free days, there will be free admission. We, like, everyone can come and experience this.
Mm-hmm.
The construction of, like, I cannot imagine what it would be like to watch the construction of this.
Chicago has such a fascinating history.
I know.
It's such an interesting place.
I know. It's crazy. I'm very jealous. My older sister, congrats, Nani, just took a job there.
Yeah.
And we'll be...
Hey, you got a visit.
I know.
Hey, whenever, you know, Southwest or whoever has a little deal, mm-hmm. you better buy those tickets.
Oh, I literally... Selfishly, I was like, so when are you moving? I'm ready.
I also learned that, I forget what the name of their other airport is, but it's a lot cheaper to fly there than into O'Hare.
I think, yeah.
My dad's
office, like, main office is in Chicago.
Oh, well,
he goes up like twice a year for, I was like, I'll just go and
your family to ride. And, your sister's going to live there now, so.
I know. I was like, my dad's going to have plenty of other reasons, but now he'll have work and a daughter there and all that. So,
my supervisor told me this week, she was like, so at work we have this program that we do, and she was talking to her supervisor about doing a presentation at the Association of Science and Technologies conference. About that. And my supervisor was like, I'm so sorry, but we can't take you, even though she's like, we just don't have the money. And she was like, I'm so sorry. I was like, it's fine.
So we'll talk about this later. You know what? I need the deets. Well, I need the tea on this.
This is the reason why I bring it up is because it's in Chicago.
I figured.
And I was just like, she's like, the only reason why is because it's in Chicago and just like the cost of travel.
I'll let you know when I'm going, and we can, it'll be a while before I can like account for it. She'll have to move. I'll save up and everything. But if we work on this, maybe we can go to sometime.
Well, I know. I mean, like, I've been, and there's just so much to do. It's the third biggest city in the country.
Well, you've also have that agreement with your friend that if either of you moves to Chicago, the other one has to move to Chicago.
It's true.
Be careful. You might end up there sooner or later. But... yeah. So within this construction, within this building, they bring back a lot of motifs that are from a more classical architecture. A lot of that grand, it's hard. Architecture is so fascinating, especially throughout history and the way we perceive it. But like that Beaux Arts, almost Greek, grand, like spires
revival.
To the sky.
Yeah.
That will always evoke some level, I think, because of its place in prominence in history, will always invoke some sort of awe to people.
Oh my God, it's gorgeous.
It's beautiful. And like, I'm not saying others aren't, but like, if you see that, you know what the attempt was.
It's so timeless too. Mm-hmm. Like, and Chicago's skyline is absolutely gorgeous.
Yes.
Like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like, they're really looking for like these soaring facades and height and grandeur, things mm-hmm. that make people just stop and go, oh my God. How does this exist? And so, like I said, that Beaux Arts design is really popular. And a lot of the facades of the buildings didn't have much to do with what was in the building at all. In fact, there was like, they were basically told, like, build these facades. It doesn't matter what the inside of the building looks like or how quality it is. Just make it look on the outside really fancy. So they weren't using materials that were like made to last. It was more like plaster and stuff like that. And, like even straw in some places. So like,
very temporary.
Very temporary, but also easy to manipulate and just make look incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So, but also think about like the construction materials and tools and time and methods and techniques that are going to be used in 1893. That does form a lot of, you know, how they can do that, their capabilities. Of course, that classical look is often associated with light color stones with symmetry and strength. And in that light colored stone, which in a lot of cases actually wasn't light colored stone, is what earned them the name the White City. This exposition specifically being called the White City because they painted everything white. Whether or not the materials used were white, they painted it all white to make it look just incredible. And this is the exposition that is famously known for its use of electricity. So if you are used to lampposts and, you know, dim, warm glows at night, think of what it was like to, for the first time, see a white painted city lit up around you
at night. Oh my God.
There's so many moments. I don't even want to see it as bad as I want to walk among the people who saw it for the first time. I just want to know what this was to them. Like, God. The hope and like prosperity and progress that they felt, and the fear.
I can't even imagine. Yeah.
Like, because I'll get into that a little bit later, but like electricity was not all that popular at this point. Yeah. So, a lot of the planning and architecture and overseeing was owed to Daniel Burnham, who's the architect, and the designer in chief named Charles Atwood. When it came down to it, there were about 14 great buildings, or so kind of, I'll put air quotes around that. Mm-hmm. At least that's what they called them. But in full total, if you counted everything they built, from little stands to vendor carts and everything, we're looking at over 200 things being built, structures being built for this.
Yeah.
And that's incredible to me. And that also includes things like canals, modifications to waterways to travel, like just it's crazy to me that they were like, hey, you want to have this 6-month event? We're going to build a city to do it. But like money.
Yeah.
You know?
Isn't it also crazy that, like, we could have really great public works if someone just decided to do it?
Or funded it and just, like, Well, and, okay, brief sidebar here. The other day I saw someone, like, on social media, and they were, like, trying to kind of gotcha questions, and they asked this girl, and they obviously expected her to be kind of, like, a ditzy, like, oh. And they asked her, and they were, like, electric cars or normal cars? And she was, like, neither. The entire concept of the fact, like, of promoting electric cars, like, it's to save the auto
industry. It's not about the environment, it's about the auto industry.
To save their reputation. And the fact is that all of that money that we spend on that should be spent and put towards public transportation that is both, like, accessible, like, for everyone. She went on this whole thing, and I was like, get it, girl. But no, it is crazy because, like, you think, I mean, obviously building codes are different. We spend different, more time, structural analysis, different standards and everything now. So we couldn't build this. We could never build this all again in this way.
And not in that way. Like, but like,
isn't it crazy that when people want to do something, they can.
They can. And that's the point. When they want to do something, they will.
If you wanted it bad enough, he would. Fry, you're all in my earphones.
Oh my goodness. Okay. Did you need to assert yourself? Hello.
Yes. So, So 200 total, 14 of the great buildings. Varying permanence was used. They had things like huge statues, and if you look up Chicago World Fair, you'll probably see one. It almost looks like the Statue of Liberty. Thanks, France. But there's like huge statues that were made to just be imposing and impressive, and it would inspire media and art for decades
to come. Is also a lot of footage of like of the World's Fair, like actually film footage, and I've seen a lot of it recolored.
I saw something like that. I love recolored.
I know, it just brings so much life to it.
If I could have, like, if there could be another life, like another career I'd gone down, the like archival effort that goes into that stuff is insane. Like,
I'm sure
people who recolor the color
accuracy. I can't even imagine.
There's a picture of
the amount of research.
Lincoln before he's like gave the Gettysburg Address or something like that is a picture, and they were talking about the process they went through to recolor it. Everything from checking the weather from that day to see how the shadows would have been cast.
Oh my god!
I was like, oh, that's so cool. But I would totally do that. So all of this, takes a while to build, obviously, and there's there's critics of it, of course. Some people who are like, hey, this short term, like, is A, not sustainable, and it's a waste of time and effort, et cetera, et cetera. You're basically building garden sheds that look pretty, which, yeah, they were. Sustainability-wise, this is not great. Yeah, this is very wasteful, if you're thinking about that. But there's some irony to that. We'll get to it later. The grounds themselves were dedicated in October of 1892 on the 21st, but they didn't open until the next year in May. So they built this thing, dedicated the ground, and built it pretty dang quickly.
Wow. Yeah.
They ended up, of course, cutting it pretty dang close. They were running, they were on the wire, and they had disputes with a couple people who resigned or had disagreements, creative differences, et cetera, et cetera. And as they were running out of time to finish the painting and some of the facades, they kind of go with this more aerosolized spraying thing. Not quite aerosolized, but a spray system that would allow them to do it much faster than having to use brush strokes. And we see that this is kind of like one of the first mass uses of that. And we see it all the time now. So, you know, even before they were purposefully breaking barriers, they were breaking barriers. Another interesting thing I found was that they're coming up on this deadline. They realize they aren't going to make it. They aren't going to finish the facades fast enough, the carvings, the ornateness that they wanted. And so they reach out to the Chicago Art Institute. And this man says something basically along the lines of, it doesn't matter, even if you hired the White Rabbits, hire the White Rabbits if you have to do it. The White Rabbits became the name for the women who worked at the Chicago Art Institute. And were the ones that they called on to, in their last dire moments,
to get it done.
Get this done. And so these women got the name White Rabbits, but were like incredible sculptors and artists, and they were all kind of pulled from their posts to be able to do this. And I thought that was just really interesting. And it kind of gave me goosebumps a little bit, because I was like, you think about like the construction work that was so dominated by men at this time and everything. But at the end of the day, they weren't going to finish this if it wasn't for the women.
Right.
And I love little things like that. Like the presence of women cannot be ignored. In these spaces.
That's so cool.
And this is some of the most impressive work, whether or not it was long, it had longevity, some of the most impressive work that people would ever see on buildings, and
absolutely
just by sheer volume. And it was completed by women.
Yeah.
It was given that touch by women in their efforts. Dang. So
I have don't send a man to do a woman's job. That's what I'm talking about.
Or don't make fun of the job expecting, oh, I guess you can even get the women to do it. Because guess what? The women are going to make it look freaking awesome.
Hell yeah.
So, obviously, the exhibitions are going to be a huge factor in this exposition.
Right, because now you've built all this stuff. What are you going to actually put in it?
What are you going to fill it with? What are you going to let people come see? And the answer is everything.
Literally everything.
it's crazy. It's everything from inventions that
you can't even, like, emphasize how much it is actually just everything.
Like, this, like, it's about progress and new inventions, but also reinventing the old and commemorating history, as this is the 400-year anniversary. Notably, this is the event where we see electricity for the first time. This is not the first time we've seen electricity used to power buildings or lights or anything like that in America by any means.
Oh my goodness. Hold on.
I got it. Sorry, we had a mic down. There's a really, I'll talk about this in a couple weeks, because I actually have an episode planned for this eventually. A lot of people are scared of electricity, of the potential fire hazards. And this is, there's something you said for the fact that there were inventors of this. Edison was involved in it too, of trying to fearmonger almost, because within the competition, I need to talk about the current wars sometimes, because like, within this competition to race for electricity, for their patents, for their knowledge and their competition between each other, there was a lot of like, oh, so-and-so's current doesn't work. That style is going to get you killed. It's going to like, they electrocuted an elephant at one point to prove a point. They did a lot of stuff that, and like fear-mongered off of it to compete with each other, not realizing that that made a lot of people terrified of the power of electricity, of having it in their homes. I'll talk about it a little bit later. I'll do another episode. But there's a really cool show that talks about this. H.J. Heinz. Yes, the Heinz tomato ketchup stuff. put electricity in his factory. He was one of the first people to do it. And all of a sudden, people from the working class were working around it, and it was safer than having lanterns, and it was safer mm-hmm. than they realized. And all of a sudden, it wasn't so scary anymore. And so, like, the slow adoption of electricity into, like, public life did a lot for its popularity. But this, on this scale, wasn't just like, oh, it can light a factory safely. It was, it can be opulent. It mm-hmm. can be ornate.
Yeah.
It can make you the class of society. And look, it's not as expensive as you might think.
Yeah.
It's more accessible.
Yeah.
But within the presentations of these lights were also inventors between people like Edison and his ilk and George Westinghouse. And even though they had displayed electricity in a similar fashion in the Paris Exposition about 4 years earlier, there was conversation like now about people could see the technology in action, yes, but also the conversations, the competitions between things that would eventually lead to like alternating current and direct current and like mm-hmm. all these different little like types of light bulb. And they even had a bidding war kind of to see who could light the Chicago World Fair.
Yeah.
And I believe Edison was like the front runner for a while, and that Westinghouse, George Westinghouse, was like, hey, actually my bulbs don't use this particular metal, it's cheaper, and like underbid him so much that they were like, oh, we're using Westinghouse.
Oh yeah, for sure.
But but still, Edison was going to be able to like present his technology there and like, you know, claim his credits, and the competition yeah. was on and everything. So it's just really fascinating to me. But this is the first time a lot of Americans would be seeing it used in this way, like in this mass context. And they made a big deal out of it. The president of their time, this had to be Grover Cleveland.
Oh, I don't know. You lose me after 1900.
Yeah. I think this is Grover Cleveland.
That sounds right.
Yeah. And they get him like up on a stage, and they put him on this huge platform, and they're like, here's a big old button. You go up there and you give a speech and you make everyone and all of you. And he does. And he makes this big production out of lighting it. And then he just switches it on. And to see what that, I wish I could have just seen what that was like for people my God. To see. I know. So a lot of those exhibits that were present at the exhibition were sponsored by individual people or companies or corporations trying to promote themselves. I mean, we see it all the time with sponsorships for events and stuff. Yeah. And the payout for this is as good as any publicity as you could get in this day and age. You could buy a front page ad and it probably wouldn't get this kind of traction, because over a quarter of America end up seeing this.
Wow. Wow. Oh my God. Wow. Oh my God.
Statistically, like I can't guarantee 25%. That that's every person. Like the number, like I'll pull up the number later, but it's like the amount of people that visited this. Maybe not necessarily like all from America, I shouldn't say that, but the amount of people that visited the exposition,
holy shit,
was over a quarter of the population known in America at the time.
Oh my God.
Like, oh there my is God. No better advertising than to put your name on something here.
Yeah.
Other inventions included things like the Ferris wheel, which was designed by an engineer from Pittsburgh named G.W.G. Ferris, I believe it's like George Washington Ferris or something was his name. Nice. And that, of course, the man who later popularized amusement parks and like Coney Island and stuff like that, had inspiration from the Chicago World Fair.
Oh, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, my God.
And some of them weren't as like... some of like the construction on this stuff, even though the Ferris wheel seems safe, wasn't as standardized. Like what was known as the greatest refrigerator on earth was a huge building that was like 200 feet tall, and it was supposed to keep food cold, and it had like an ice rink for people to skate on. But the machinery there got so hot that it actually set the building on fire, and it killed 12 firefighters and 4 workers. So like, obviously for all of our progress, there's still a long way to go on safety measures, on mm-hmm. like standardization of procedures and everything. But we see inventions of all scales here. The precursor to kind of like the escalator, like the ones we see in airports, that is just like a sidewalk on a little like rolly thing that you kind of get to stand on.
The people mover?
Yeah, the moving walkway
thing. I love those so much. I know. They are so fun.
They're fun. But that was introduced here like hundreds of years before it would be, or at least a couple hundred years.
Ugh.
No? Oh my God, I can't do math. Over a hundred years. Few decades, 100 years or so before we'd see it in like airports and stuff like that. I can't do math. But there's also like less grand technological inventions. Like the zipper was first shown here.
Wow.
Can you imagine how revolutionary it is to be like a woman thinking about, damn, tonight like, I got to get home and unbutton this whole damn thing.
And like untie myself out of it. Yeah.
And then to be like, oh my God.
Yeah.
This thing just zips. And oh, it's like God. Also for lower class women, that's going to be a heck of a lot easier.
Right.
Wrigley's chewing gum shows up here. Ready-made pancake mix, namely the Aunt Jemima pancake mix, Cracker Jacks, even dishwashing machines show up for the first time here.
Wow.
Peanut butter, cream of wheat, shredded wheat, Vienna sausages, a printing press for Braille books. Like,
wow.
And Helen Keller and Ann Sullivan did show up to the fair and met with the inventor of the Braille book printer. Aerosolized spray, the first conceptual electric automobile, like, some of this stuff is so, is like 100 years before it's time as we know it. And that's the really interesting thing about inventions and progress and how we see things pick up in popularity or not pick up in popularity is that like we've had things around a lot.
People
longer.
Have had ideas for a long time. Yeah.
And it's big conversations too about like what would have happened if the Library of Alexandria hadn't burned.
Mm-hmm.
What would have happened if such and such invention hadn't been paid attention to? There's conversations about...
If they had really devoted a lot of time to that electric car and not oil cars.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the question, too, of, like, even now, we hear about people who are working on cures for cancer and stuff like that, and they end up, like, dead.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, what information, what inventions, and this is not me being a conspiracy theorist, but there is, like, a scary... If you're really looking at it, the amount of people that make big medical advancements and end up dead is kind of scary.
Suspicious, to say the least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they're usually in medical fields that are very prosperous to either big pharma or like government agencies and stuff. So like, I'm not trying to be conspiracy theorists here, but like there's so many ideas that throughout history, I'm like, who lobbied against the popularity of it?
Yeah.
Who could have been the ones, like, trying to not talk about
it? Well, it's like that guy who, like, invented the car that runs on water, which I know is kind of a running joke, but I think he also ended up dead.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, very quickly after. Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, it's hard to tell, like, what just didn't pick up at the time.
Yeah.
And what was, like, ignored intentionally.
Right, on purpose. Yeah.
So, it really makes your brain kind of wonder.
Oh, my gosh.
My favorite sweatshirt, baby.
Sorry, he's...
No, you're good.
Being special.
You're good. I'm just gonna sit like this. One of the early forms of moving pictures was shown here, which made the exhibition essentially one of the first public use movie theaters, like commercial use movie theaters.
Wow.
If you think about it, because people would like go to see it, so it's kind of like commercialized movies. Chicago. This is where we developed the Chicago-style hot dog with beef sausage. Blue Ribbon, a.k.a. Pabst Beer, was popularized at this event after
Pabst
winning...
Blue Ribbon.
Yeah.
Ice.
Well, they won the Blue Ribbon Prize here.
Ah.
And that's where they got their name.
And then Lana Del Rey sang about it. Over 100 years later.
What a world. Brownies can also trace their origins to the Chicago World Fair. If it tells you anything about just like how grand they were going over in Spain, they commissioned real life size versions of the Niña, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria be made.
Yeah.
And then they brought them to the exhibition from Spain. Someone had to sail replicas
they sailed the
of
ocean
Columbus's
blue.
Ships again. 400 years later.
In 1893. Damn it. It doesn't rhyme.
I think they probably shipped them over in 92. I'm going to go with that.
Yeah, that's it.
But they had like Viking ships made.
Yeah.
Like they had all kinds of stuff just sitting in the water, and they were like, "Hey guys, we're gonna go see like Columbus's actual ships." I cannot imagine. Actually,
literally imagine if they try to do something like that today.
God,
oh my God, that would be insane.
And that tells you like how many like different delegates and communities and countries had to work together to like do this stuff.
It's the World's Fair.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
some of the greatest. Like composers and singers and artists of their time would show up here. It's also important throughout all of this awe to remember that this is serving a very specific demographic. Yes, the Gilded Age was here, so you have workers and high class people. But women and people of color were fighting tooth and nail to have space or to have representation in the exhibits, to have representation for themselves, mm-hmm. not just as visitors, but as part of progress, mm-hmm. to be represented among this,
right.
something to be proud of.
Right.
Again, I mean, look at the year. Women aren't voting at this point, but there is a socialite from Chicago named Bertha Palmer, who was on the board of Lady Managers, which was like kind of unprecedented in and of itself to have an advisory board that was made of women. But she's part of the reason that they were able to establish a building specifically for women at the fair. It was designed by a woman and featured women's art and in products and inventions, et cetera, et cetera. Women did have a very interesting discussion about whether it was better to have their exhibits mixed in with the men's or to have a dedicated mm. building to be that space just for women, mm-hmm. to like laud, you know, their inventions and all of that, which if that sounds kind of familiar, it's, oh, Fry almost broke that one.
He already knocked that plant over and I don't know if it's gonna survive.
Oh.
Ugh.
Yeah.
He's really pissing me off right now. Okay. Anyway.
Continue. But yeah, so they ended up with their own building, but that like inspires a lot of that thought of like, how do you represent people? How do you give them a space to right. acknowledge them and a safe space?
Right.
And that's still better treatment than the African American community got at this, of mm-hmm. course, which would be, I mean, if you think about it, do you need to go check?
No, okay. He's just got something.
Okay. We're hearing stuff clattering around upstairs.
Oh my God.
But suffrage is coming. The discussions about suffrage. Mm-hmm. And this is going to look very familiar of women getting rights before African-American people and yep. women saying like, sorry, it's the most we can do. Yep. And not necessarily turning around in the same yoke and not all of them supporting in turn and being yep. like, hey, we got this privilege. They should too.
Susan B. Anthony.
She sucks. But thank you, Frederick Douglass.
Yes.
If you need any more on that, go back a little bit into... Oh.
You just spoiled it.
I did. Okay. Yeah. I'm not going to say it. We have an episode that would be great for you. I'll
yes.
back.
Yes.
But... So... Sorry, there's just a lot of stuff falling upstairs.
Sounds like he's got like a... I don't even know. It sounds like a chopstick yeah. almost, but there's not a chopstick upstairs. Oh my God. Okay. Sorry if you can hear that on the mics.
African American inventors and exhibits were denied, or, well, they were told that they had to be approved by an all white panel.
Oh, of course.
So essentially, denied in a lot of cases. Yeah. And civil rights leaders weren't just going to take that lying down, so they started pushing back, including some famous names that you will recognize from previous episodes, such as Ida B. Wells and Frederick Douglass. A lot of them wrote on the matter, noting that, like, the Civil War is over, so why are you still doing this? Why are you still right. acting like slavery is a thing? Like, we're supposed to be moving past this.
Yeah.
But it should be notable that we see a lot of precedent being set here. The mm-hmm. precedent of women being like, hey, we got what we needed. Good luck with your thing.
Right.
But also, like, difficulties within social civil rights movements, struggling about how to react to things. How do yeah. we, like, agree? Because Ida B. Wells is writing about boycotting. Like, hey, until we have representation, like, we shouldn't be supporting this.
Yeah.
But then there's Frederick Douglass, who was serving as a representative for Haiti at the event. And yeah. he's like, no, go. Make your presence known. Remind people that you belong in these spaces, right. that you consume this progress, that you are a part of this nation and progress, and like be there, be a presence.
Yeah.
And they're both very valid points.
Yeah.
And I can see where they're both coming from. And we see that even now about how people are unsure how to best support movements, mm-hmm. how to best effectively make change. So they end up giving the other precedent that they set is that they give minorities their own days at the fair. Like, they had, like, an African-American day and stuff like that. But notably, they were also giving white minorities their days as well. Which, to be fair, if we're talking about, like, racism in America, there is some pretty heavy racism against, like, immigrants of all kinds. This is the age of that. I mean, Italians, Irish immigrants were not treated well. There's all kinds of racism.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it just hadn't been as institutionalized or systemic as slavery had been. So they try to kind of like give minorities these like days. But what does that what precedent does that sound like? The way that they're doing this, it's separate but equal.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, separate but equal is going to be a huge conversation for the next couple decades here. And it's going to be something that people have to fight against and prove themselves against down the line.
Yeah.
And it makes me, I keep comparing it to like the Smithsonian's, how there is an African-American Museum of History and Culture. And it's like, and I'm grateful that a lot of museums are making that change that like, hey, the other museums should have stuff about like African-American history in it. But it's also important to not only include it in the larger narrative, but to have those designated safe spaces to do both.
Yeah.
To make sure that you're providing both to people.
Yeah, it's definitely a balance. So, it's a tricky one.
Yeah. So, like, it's very interesting to me how many precedents this set and how many issues it was highlighting that had already started to manifest themselves systemically in society. There were exhibits by African Americans that did get approved and included, notably names such as George Washington Carver, also Edmonia Lewis.
Yes.
What episode was that? That wasn't that long ago.
That wasn't too long ago.
It was one about like destroyed artifacts or something like that we had talked about.
Yeah, I don't remember off the top of my head, but it was recently.
Yeah. Yes. But
oh, it was in November because she was part Indigenous.
Ah, okay. Yes. Yeah. But some people like Buffalo Bill Cody weren't welcome or were rejected outright. He sets up his own Wild West show outside of the exhibition a couple blocks away. So like people found a way to still like assert themselves.
If people were going to be in town, then you're going to see a whole lot of things pop up, including do you know what I'm going to say?
Say it.
Our good friend first serial killer in America.
Oh, yeah, he comes up. Yeah. Oh, of course
I was like, there's no way Kat's going to leave him out. Oh, that's honestly why I've been so hesitant to do it, because he's so connected to the World's Fair that I'm like,
I know.
I can't do both.
I know. That's part of the reason I was like, I'll do this now.
Yeah.
And good call, soon down the line, Cal can talk about H.H. Holmes.
Yes.
Like when you're dealing with 700 acres, it's not like you have police outside every square meter being like, hey, are you allowed to be doing your show here?
Right.
Like people are just like walking around having a good time.
Yeah.
In its own way, the Chicago World Fair was also intended to be a way to introduce people to new cultures.
And it did it in a very 1890s white way.
Yes. So there was an attempt to have like different areas with different cultural groups there, demonstrations and art and performances from those countries, which in theory can be really great for edification. Like to be able to like walk through, it's like going to, I imagine it as like an attempt to be Epcot.
Right. Yes.
To like have, like to be able to walk through and be like, oh, like this is an around the world thing, which would have been so cool if it was done well. But let's like, and there were a lot of countries, to be fair, sent nations and countries and cultures that sent delegates to accurately represent their cultures. But not all of these exhibitions were done necessarily with that attention to detail and authenticity in mind.
Or care.
Yeah. Insensitivity. There was a good bit of stuff here that was kind of fetishized.
Yeah.
And Orientalism is a huge thing still. Mm-hmm. Like, this is where we first see belly dancing in a suggestive form, the way that now we conceptualize it.
Yeah.
Because of, like, fetishization of culture and the awe factor. And everyone, I mean, even if you're at the World Fair, you're still fighting for like visitors. You want visitors to come to your area. You want to create the spectacle that people are like, oh, did you go see the Egypt section? There's a belly dancer there. She has her stomach showing. Like, you know?
Right.
And so we have almost an exploitation of cultures in some ways.
Yep.
And this is, again, in a time when museums, like, there were human beings
on display
in museums. And like, in this era of
And I'm sure you talk about it, like, too, but the stuff that was brought to Chicago for the 1890s World Fair is the founding collection for the Field Museum in Chicago.
Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I saw a couple mentions of that, because the Field Museum is actually due in large part to one of the existing buildings that did remain.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's really hard to talk about this, like, museum stuff sometimes.
Yeah.
And not get on my soapbox about it.
Yeah, not really go off on a really long tangent.
Because, like,
it's fascinating.
Cal and I are actively in an industry that is both trying to undo generations of harm.
And I will say, the Field You've been.
I actually have not been to the Field Museum.
No, you haven't? Mm-mm. Okay. So I've been, and I've been...
I know all about it, but yeah, I haven't been in it.
It's a difference. It's different now working in museums, going to museums like pre-working in museums mm-hmm. and post-working in museums.
Yeah.
So I've been since I've been like in the museum field. I went when I was
that's
in grad
right.
school.
You sent me that picture
yeah.
of
and
that exhibit that yes. did the yeah. acknowledgement. Oh, yeah.
And I will say the field is very aware of its history mm-hmm. and it seems like it's really doing a lot to overcome it. And not, I don't even think overcome. I think just kind of like deal with it.
Acknowledge it.
And reckon with it and kind of try to like make correction, like make mm-hmm. it as right as they can. Not erase it, but like acknowledge it and be like, this is how we're moving forward.
And that's the weird part about working in museums too, is that like by nature, we work in an industry that has a very messy, bad, exploitative history.
Yeah.
And you know that the only way to change that is to be a part of the change.
Yeah.
To advocate.
It's like the only
it.
Way out is through.
Yes.
Yeah. And like it's your decision as an institution. Mm-hmm. Am I going to be like a leading voice in that? Or am I going to kind of ride the wave?
Right.
You know?
Right. And it's different working in small museums where I work in collections. I'm mm-hmm. very aware. I found some stuff this week that immediately I was like, oh, I found stuff in a box that I was like, okay, hands off right now.
Yeah.
Because there's a chance it was from indigenous mm-hmm. people who were on the property before me. And I was like, there are rules depending on if there are ceremonial items and stuff. That as a woman,
who can touch what
physically as a woman, as like if you're pregnant or not. Like there's so many things that immediately I was like, my due diligence right now is to step back, know that it's here, contact someone, make sure that I'm okay to handle this object, and then like start talking, like figure out if this is something that needs to be repatriated. And even mm-hmm. if it doesn't need to be legally repatriated, I owe it to people, to the community, mm-hmm. to culture, to reach out to someone and be like, hey, I believe this is yours.
Right.
How would you like, are you okay with me having it? Mm-hmm. Are you okay with us presenting it? How would mm-hmm. you like it presented if so? Like, and the hard thing is when you are in an industry like ours where it's always been wrong,
mm-hmm.
you also have to acknowledge that what we are doing now will inevitably someday be viewed as against the zeitgeist. Like,
right.
We can do everything we can, but eventually this conversation will mm-hmm. probably not be politically correct.
Yeah.
And like accepting that
and
knowing that the only thing you can do is take the next step forward
and the best you can in that moment. Yeah.
It's hard. And it's like, you're going to have to constantly reckon with yourself your whole life and ask yourself, how can I improve? How, like, where mm-hmm. are things moving? And so like having at no point should there have been human beings on display in museums.
No.
At no point should, like, there's so many
living
things,
human beings
like that are obvious, but looking at moments like this, it's really interesting to see how far we've come, but also that there are people in museums and institutions that don't want to acknowledge it
mm-hmm.
or that don't follow through with repatriation requests.
Yeah.
There's a museum that I actually really enjoy going to, an art museum that has human remains on display.
Hmm.
And I didn't realize it until the last time I was through, because I was like looking with a more critical lens.
It's the difference between before and after working in museums.
And and knowing too, like before it was like, oh, this item is on loan. And then like something when I was like, I read an article later about, I think it's Cairo. The museum has like officially asked for all human remains, like mummies, to be repatriated. Mm-hmm. I think at this point, I could be wrong about that, but I'm pretty sure. And it made me realize like, wait a second. I think the one in the collection that I saw was from Egypt. And if that's the case, they're ignoring repatriation requests.
Yeah.
And that's not okay. Like,
it's
just,
you can't do that. Yeah.
And that's kind of our soapbox, and I'll get off of it, but like,
yeah, there's a lot there.
We could say a lot. But the impact this has on history, on the world, and how people view other cultures cannot be minimized.
Yeah.
Because people were allowed to like, not just walk around and experience things in good faith, but kind of like ogle them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's being put on display. It's literally like,
and not all of them were.
Yeah. Well, and then also think about too, like you have this rush to get everything to Chicago
mm-hmm.
in time for the fair.
Mm-hmm.
And that leads to I mean, it's not like we were doing great with our the way we got
our
artifacts and everything from other countries. But think about like the if you are like having to get shit to Chicago in time, how much less care, if it's even possible, you have to handle things respectfully and get the right things and also pay for them and not steal from everything.
And how tempting it is to just be like, hey, your grandma was from here, right? You know about this.
Yeah.
And so there were delegations that did a lot of due diligence and wanted to like educate people and provide them with these cool, which is so fantastic. And I wish that there was something I could go to that looks like this now.
Oh my God. Yeah.
In a more politically correct way. I would love to like go on a cultural around the world experience.
I will say the Field Museum. Oh my God. Okay. First of all, before we went, someone told us the Field is an all day thing. And it is. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. If you go, it's all day.
Okay.
My friends who I love dearly
are not museum people.
was really trying to impress that upon them. We got there at 2 and they closed at 5.
Oh no.
Yes. Oh, so I was really trying to be like, y'all, we've got to go.
That hurts my little
we've
got
to go. They didn't quite understand. And they were like, oh my God, there's so much here. And I'm like, yeah, that's what I was telling you.
It's
like,
can we go?
So, but because the founding collection is the World's Fair and because that was the vibe of the World's Fair, they do have, it's kind of like, it feels very reminiscent of that where they have like, it is kind of like an around the world tour.
It is my first place I got
to
go.
Have to go.
I think I didn't go before because we had like the whole family.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, and I also had a friend with me at that point and we hit the Chicago Museum of Art, which.
Yeah.
Oh.
We didn't do that. We did. One museum, and I opted for the Field.
Yeah.
And but next time I go, I'm definitely going to the art museum.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think because my little sister and I and my friend were all in a performance featured around George Seurat's art.
Oh.
And so we were like, we really want to see this. We're here. Like,
yeah,
and
it's kind of like you have to pick. You have to pick.
And, but the next one, I'm literally just gonna be like, I'm gonna like purposely go. Maybe my dad will go for work. And I can be like, drop me
just
off.
Just drop me
way
off
to
at the museum. Yep.
Don't come back for me until the end of the day. Like, I'll find my way to a restaurant and eat or something like that. Just like, I won't even be taking lunch breaks. I'll just be all day.
Yes. Yeah. So. No, and it's, and oh my God, it's a huge, it's like you don't realize how big it is until you're in it, which I feel like is a lot of museums, but like it's.
But no, yeah.
Yeah.
I gotta, for sure. I cannot wait. Oh, it's top of my list now.
Yeah.
So, with all of that being said, there's a lot of like, I think there's a book on it, on like exploitation that begins with the World Fair, like how it changed like the industry and the field and everything.
Yeah.
But it is interesting. It's also interesting to hear people's takes on that from like cultural perspectives. So I do recommend if you're interested in like how museums have like changed since then or like how it was done there, I would read up on that because I don't have the time to go through every exhibit and every like display that was right or was not right. But all in all, it contributed to a massively successful exposition. I mean, how do you determine the success of an event like this? To how many tourists it brings to Chicago? To, like, the money you raise? The travel tickets you sold? Like, whatever metric you use, this one was pretty much successful.
Yeah.
It ran for 6 months, May 1st to 1893 until October 30th. It was successful enough that even though the original plan was to run it 6 days of the week and be closed only on Sundays, the Chicago Women's Club was like, hey, y'all got to keep it open all 7 days. People who are working the rest of the time want to come see it on their day off. And it's like their only day. Like, you can't close it on Sundays. Everyone deserves it, which is a conversation, too, about like the working class.
Yeah,
making it accessible.
For sure. That's a really good point.
Kind of like the discussion about like voting.
Yeah.
Like, you need to have the day off. Like, it should be a federal holiday.
It should be a holiday.
Why the people who usually can't take off are the demographics who already have less access to voting privileges. Like, I could go on a bit rant about that too. So that says something too about the popularity that it reached across both the working class all the way up to the gilded class, as I'll call it, the upper class. But if your metric is just how many people visited, you're totaling like people that paid and people that got in free. You're looking at something over 25 million visitors.
Holy crap.
25 million visitors.
That's
in 6 months.
Unfathomable.
I cannot fathom it.
That is
insane. And that kind of accounts for the fact that like they took out the people that they think visited like multiple times.
Uh-huh.
Like that's
uh-huh.
trying to think about like raw just numbers.
Like just how many like people
but, yeah
mm-hmm. yeah not separate visits but yeah
individuals
people.
Walk through that door yeah. The estimates still range by a couple million though, like some I'm people sure. think it was up to 28 or something like
you
that.
You can't even count, you can't count, you yeah. can't count that many.
And plenty of people did come back and forth because yeah. they were like, you can't see all that in one
well,
day.
Well, if you're going to see this, you're not just gonna like pop in for the day and then leave. Like you're gonna like you're in Chicago, you're staying there for, you know, an extended period of time,
yeah.
you'd think. And then especially like at this time with the people who like the higher classes, they had a whole thing where they're like, I'm going to go visit my friend and stay mm-hmm. for a month. And, you know, we're all going to go on holiday because I'm filthy uh-huh. rich and I've got nothing better to do.
Right. Yeah. Versus like, I can go one Sunday
yeah.
once a month.
Yeah.
The rest of the time I have to be at yeah. church, and or I can only go for a couple hours after church or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, myself of hours alive during the Chicago World Fair. Oh
yeah.
Oh.
Oh my god, could you imagine? Oh my god. Oh, I would throw up.
I would have to like quit my job.
Yeah, I'd quit my job.
Yeah.
I'd quit my job and I'd go and join like the Buffalo Bills thing.
Yeah. Oh, that's exactly.
They could shoot apples off my head. Yeah.
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 Oh, I would quit and be there 6 months. If I came back and my boss was like, you still got a job, I'd be like, great. But honestly, I would have spent all 6 months there.
Yeah, mm. yeah. Chances are, I mean, I'd be doing factory work anyway. So it'd just be like, that's okay, true. Someone else will hire me.
That like, is very much true. So tens of millions of dollars were spent on preparing for this event, which is astronomically high considering at the time that this was like, like, the amount of money, I just should have done the conversion math, but tens of millions in their money in the 18, like, 90, like, oh my god, can you imagine how much money that would have been in our time?
Like, billions.
Like, it's insane.
Yeah.
And over 21 million people came to see this, some paying admission, some on free access and everything, but if you're looking for, like, being in the, like being in the black and not in the red,
mm-hmm.
they still broke even. That's the kind of money this thing brought in. It was, they probably ended up with, I think, like $500,000 sitting in the box office. So that tells you, like, by a monetary standpoint, $500,000 for spending millions and millions is not a lot of profit, but they still broke even.
Yeah.
Which is like insane considering yeah. they spent tens of millions in yeah. this time's
well
money.
And that's not even like, so that's just like admission, right?
Yeah. And that's not to say
like
vendors.
The economic boom mm-hmm. for the city,
yes,
the people staying in hotels and restaurants mm-hmm. eating, grocery stores, public transit,
the consumerism this encouraged,
yes, shopping,
like,
yeah,
inventions that people would go home and order through
and
their
buy, exactly,
catalog.
Yeah,
like, it's almost incomprehensible.
No, I mean the effect that would have had on the economy.
Yeah, and yeah. to think, like, you know, 25 million, somewhere between 21 and 28 million people mm-hmm. visit.
Yeah,
America's population is sitting somewhere around 70 million.
Jesus Christ, that's insane.
Huge.
In one city in 6 months.
Yes.
25 million people yes. came through.
And that's not all American citizens, to be fair. It's from all over the world.
Right.
But, like,
but it's still people.
Uh-huh.
It's incomprehensible.
Uh-huh. I can't imagine, like, I'm sure a bunch of, like, Canadian people came too. It wasn't that far as,
yeah.
like, coming up from
no,
Texas.
Right.
But, like,
yeah.
God, I would have sat on a train for 2 weeks.
Oh my god.
Go,
I mean, like, the travel industry, getting
yeah.
the cities that are like the stopover cities.
Uh-huh.
Like people coming from Europe, I'm sure they stopped somewhere along the East Coast. Like,
oh, yeah.
and spent money there. Like, it's
the influx.
Yeah.
And we've talked about this before, that like movies who don't properly, like, they're set in a like decade or time, and then they're like, they don't acknowledge huge things going on. But if you were to like set a movie in like Chicago in this part of the
yeah.
decade, like
yeah.
you would have to acknowledge, like,
yes.
someone at least have an extra in the background, like talking in an accent from somewhere else and be like, it's so busy here, and
yeah.
someone else being like, well, the fair is in the
yeah.
like, just
yeah.
acknowledge this stuff, because it creates that context around the time that so radically alters how we perceive these events. Anyways,
yeah. It's
so yeah, they more than break even. American pride. America's like, yeah, hell yeah, we did this. Look at this thing. Everyone else, you thought your symposiums were great, exhibitions were great. Look at this. We're even better.
Mm.
So America's got a bit of a bragging right at this moment. There are so many famous people, musicians, who not only got their start, but were already famous in their own right. People traveled from all over the world to perform. People like Harry Houdini were there. Like,
sorry.
You're good. Yeah. Like, people like Harry Houdini are, like, showing up and doing their stuff. Like, it's just...
Why not?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there are some notable non-successes that come from Chicago at this point.
I'm sure.
Things that are not so great. I don't want to get too... Okay, let's just dive in. So, there's a smallpox epidemic.
Classic.
That's, like...
Super spreader!
Literally. Yeah. 25 million people. It's a super spreader. Like, this... Like, it was... It can largely be attributed to the fair. Like, 25 million people, by the time they hit October, like, the fall weather, they were like, oh, this is a straight-up pandemic. Or epidemic. They're like, this is bad, and it's very obviously hitting Chicago very hard. Yeah. And I was like, that would do it. The assassination of the mayor, Carter Harrison Sr. He was mayor. Okay, notably, this guy's mayor during the Haymarket Affair.
Oh,
or bombing, depending on who you would like. Oh, to call it. His involvement in that was he was there and he was like, don't hurt the strikers, because he had a lot of sympathy from those people in his voting and reelection campaigns and all that. But then he left before things got dicey, so do it that way you will.
Yeah.
But he was actually loosely related to William Henry Harrison, the short-term president who got sick and died at his inauguration.
What a really good family.
I know.
Someone put a curse on them for sure.
Okay, but honestly, he had five... terms. He had five terms as mayor, so I he did have a pretty good run. I got
well there
that.
You go. I mean, if it ends in assassination, what are you gonna do?
That's true.
It's like FDR.
I know.
Sorry.
Okay, but they weren't successful. They tried.
Well, he still died in his fifth term.
Oh, that's true. Time. No, oh no, it's the other kid. Everyone got shot in the chest with the book. And then, like, his little, like, speech stopped it and he pulled it out and kept going.
Oh my
like,
god.
Sorry, I had the wrong thing in my head.
Yeah,
it's
okay.
But no,
it's
you
okay.
were correct. But yeah, Carter Harrison Sr. was pretty good at garnering popularity. That's how he got to the fifth re-election. He was pretty good with the lower class and upper class. But unfortunately, during his run for re-election, he had given a man named Patrick Prendergast the impression that if Patrick was to help, like, his campaign and get him help reelected, that Harrison would help get him a job and later in his administration. And when that didn't pan out, Patrick went to Harrison's home and shot him on October 28th of 1893, which October 28th is my birthday.
Oh, happy birthday. day in history.
I know. I was like, dang, I actually, like, don't have a lot that I know of that happened on my birthday in history. So that was like my, oh, okay, I'll take it.
Yeah.
But this was 2 days before the closure of the exposition.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He had, Harrison had been fluctuating in popularity as of late, and had riled up some of the more elite voters and Republicans, but he had maintained a lot of support from the working class. He was a couple months into his most recent term, and he was delivering a speech at the American Cities Day of the World Columbian Exposition, and he was assassinated later that night, 2 days before it ended.
Wow.
So they ended up having, like, they changed the huge ending ceremonies, like, celebration for the closing, into a memorial ceremony for him.
Yeah.
The assassin would later, Patrick Prendergast, would eventually be hanged for his crime. But we also can't talk about unfortunate things happening at Chicago World Fair without at least mentioning H.H. Holmes.
No, we cannot.
Earliest serial killers in American, and Chicago has, like, a really interesting, like, it is the epicenter for, like, some really rough serial killers throughout history.
Also some just of them, like, crime
active at the same time. Yeah. Like, it's very interesting.
Chicago is a fascinating place.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
And so I'm not gonna talk too much about that right now because
yes, it will be another. Like I said earlier,
soon.
I'm glad you're doing this.
But I do. I would be remiss if I didn't mention it.
No, you got to. You got to.
He did attend the fair with two of his victims, Annie and Minnie Williams. So, like,
if you don't know, just like a brief explanation of that is H.H. Holmes used the World's Fair and set up his like murder house as a hotel for people coming to either work or visit the World's Fair.
He was messed up.
He
preyed on people who were there, in many ways.
And used kind of the chaos of 25 million people coming through a city to get away with it.
Because travelers, tourists, there is no easier demographic to go missing.
Oh, yeah.
Which is why you gotta be careful. Especially women.
Especially women, and especially people who are there looking for work at the World's Fair.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's true. But yeah, I didn't want to give too much detail, but H.H. Holmes exists. I think we had talked about that being our next, and I think we're planning to do that for our next theme episode. So it'll come up pretty soon.
Yes.
But yeah, that's a thing. So I just wanted to mention it. But the even though serial killers are notoriously bad for market value, the lasting impact on tourism and property values was almost, I mean, it's immediate and it's massive, but the legacy of this thing itself is a whole different beast. It inspired growth of, like, the Palace of Fine Arts is now the Museum of Science and Industry. And what was the World's Congress building became the Art Institute of Chicago. Some of those buildings were obviously reinforced and built up over time. But it starts this growth as part of a resurgence of a city building from a fire. Things like electricity that have been intimidating previously and scary to a lot of people are now like no longer an unknown. They see it in action. They see that they're safe. They see that they're trusted by people. And it's tangible. It's doable for themselves. And that inspires a huge change across America because of workers doing all the wiring even. It's like they realized, hey, we have to standardize this. And they write like a code, an updated written code about electrical handling that's still in place today and updated to this day. And this is only part of the whole story of the War of the Currents, which was Westinghouse and Edison. There's also a movie on that that has Benedict Cumberbatch and Tom Holland in it. America was, through this, seen as more than just a rural expansionary place with like industrialization going on in the background. There's progress in a new heights. It's prominent on a world stage coming out of the Civil War, when a lot of the world was like, what is this country going to look like now? What is their structure going to look like? How are they going to hold themselves? But industrialism, while it has its point, like this resurgence of this style and design shows up in a lot of courthouses and municipal buildings even to this day, that Beaux Arts style resurged. If you're in Texas, almost every downtown is going to have some hint of the Beaux Arts style in it. Classical architecture revamps within that desire for industrialization, but also the acknowledgement of parks and in beauty within, like paying attention to the beauty within a city. It spurs the City Beautiful movement, which has a lot of staying power and encourages cities to maintain green areas as they develop and grow. And so that was early on an important part of Chicago's efforts, which you can see in the cities like that grew too fast to be like, oh, maybe we should add a park, because like there's some cities that are built around them. Some cities that are like, we forgot. So let's just throw that here. Fortunately, not a lot of the buildings still stand. Some of the prominent ones do and were kind of refurbished and added and reinforced, but they were never intended to last for very long. They were built with like straw and stucco that wasn't intended for longevity. And honestly, like, unfortunately, I don't know what they expected, because a fire comes through a little bit after the...
You think Chicago, of all places.
I know. But when you're using so many like dry materials like that, that are meant to just kind of burn, and be done and everything, like, it happens. And so not long after the fair ended, a lot of it did burn down. And you can find photos of it. A lot of people took pictures and stuff. There's so many... It's such an important place in history that you can not only find books on it, but most history books written about American culture that talk about this decade at all will mention this.
Yeah.
So you can find a lot of reading if you want like full lists of all of the inventions and all the fantastic, fascinating stuff that they had. I highly encourage it, because it gives you an idea of what 25 million people traveled so far for to experience. And it is definitely mm-hmm. one of the things that I wish I could go back and see. It's on my list.
Yeah, for sure. Oh my God. Could you imagine?
No, I can't. And that's the sad thing. My imagination cannot go to those depths, to that breadth. But I will use it to make a recommendation for the day.
Mm-hmm.
Because Devil in the White City by Eric Larson is a very good book. Yeah. And that's going to be my recommendation for the day because it tells the story of H.H. Holmes through the context of the World Fair.
Yeah.
So there's like, it's very much a story told through a history book.
Yeah.
Which is a really interesting way to read history. And I had a couple of people who were like, there's a lot of like long exhibition. And I was like, yeah, because it's not just about H.H. Holmes. It's about the context it happened in the Chicago World's Fair.
You have to know.
Yeah. So I actually really enjoyed that book. I enjoy Eric Larson's writing a good bit too. He also wrote in The Garden of Beasts, which I like a lot. But that's going to be my recommendation. If you like that kind of thing, it's info heavy, but it still tells a story. And mm-hmm. it's a good way to learn about history, especially in an event like this. So yeah, Devil in the White City by Eric Larson. And you can learn about H.H. Holmes and the Chicago World Fair.
Nice. That's a good recommendation. I mean, okay, hold on, pause. Thank you for doing that. That was such a good... Oh, I'm so glad. I'm so glad. That one's... Oh, I'm so glad you did that.
I wasn't sure which of us was finally going to get to it first.
No, I'm so glad you did it. I'm so glad you did it.
I was ready.
Yeah, and so, brava.
Thank you.
Excellent job.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes. Recommendation. Shit.
Yes.
You know, again, I'll say, we do this every week, and every week I'm still like,
Do you need to pause for a second?
What have I done? I've done nothing. I've done nothing recently.
You made a very cool craft.
What?
Oh. Little banners.
Well, yeah, I did that, but that was a while ago.
You can make that to make some seasonal crafts.
There you go. Okay, yes. So as we are in, I'm sure everyone's heard this, but this is the year of not over-consuming. So,
is that what we're calling it?
I think that's what a lot of people are calling it. Yeah. So, a lot of times overconsumption happens around the holidays. And so I guess my recommendation would be, just be a little bit more intentional with how you decorate for the holidays. If you can do it handcrafted, there's always charm in handcrafted stuff too, that you can't find. Mm-hmm. And usually you're spending less money and, than you would, on some normal stuff. So, so Valentine's Day is coming up. Make a little Valentine's Day craft.
I associate Christmas with consumption because like that there's so much gift giving, but like as someone who's single, I've never really seen it as like consuming or giving or anything like that. And like if you think about it, there is a lot of like not needless but people who like buy decorations and like mm-hmm. throw them away or something like that, like disposable stuff,
and
that
doesn't need to happen. Just like I mean there's also like, you know, kind of like an Instagram and like kind of Pinterest culture of like decorating for each mm-hmm. holiday and just like going over the top and everything,
yeah,
and
which
you don't
is fun,
have to do that, which is it's fun, but it leads and it encourages a lot of overconsumption. But so
I like that to be like conscious about it.
Okay,
I'm ready for you to hit me with whatever you got.
So I am going to be doing a little bit of a biography on Gordon Parks, and
I had never heard that name before.
I had also never heard of him before, and let me tell you, I really enjoyed learning about him because he was just like, he was really kind of like a jack of all trades, and he was incredibly talented at what he did.
Okay.
So, as with most biographies, let's start with his early life. He was born in Fort Scott, Kansas, which is a really small rural town. His parents are Andrew Jackson Parks and Sarah Ross, and his birthday is November 30th, 1912. And he was the youngest of 15 children. 15.
I'm sorry, what?
15. That's quite a big family.
I'm scared.
He apparently, I was listening to a podcast about him, and he apparently was actually born dead, and the doctor that delivered him, like, I guess had the, he dunked him into a bath of, like, ice water, and that, like, jolted him, like, alive.
Like, he was stillborn?
I don't know what the, like, this is also 1912, so, I don't know if he was just, like, almost dead or like you
wasn't
know
breathing
something and, was yeah. wrong, but The doctor was able to save his life, and that's why he was named Gordon, is his mother named him after the doctor that delivered him.
Aww, yeah, that's sweet. Yeah. Also, after 15,
yeah,
I feel like
you're names, running out of names. You're like, you're reaching. Okay. You're like, oh, great, good.
You're like, cool, Gordon.
Done.
But that is sweet, though, if to name after the person who saved him.
So his father was a vegetable farmer, and this community was so small and so poor that while it's 1912 and obviously segregation did exist, he actually attended an integrated school because it just like couldn't afford to support two schools.
There was only one
There was only one school. However, the black students still faced the degree of segregation that the town could kind of afford to give them, which meant that they were not allowed to play in sports or attend any sort of social activities that the school sponsored. And actually, black students were actively discouraged from getting like from developing any sort of like aspirations for themselves. And Parks himself like recounts, he writes an autobiography that is published the year before he dies. And he remembers that like he was straight up told by a teacher like, oh, I know you want to do this college thing, but don't do that. So unfortunately his mother would pass when he was 14 years old. And he was sent to St. Paul, Minnesota to live with an older sister and her husband. However, he and her husband did not get along at all and argued frequently. And it was to the point where Parks was actually thrown out of the house and he was homeless at the age of 15. So obviously he's struggling to make a living and his mother had actually taught him piano at an early age and he was decently talented. And so he was hired as a piano player for a brothel in St. Paul.
Interesting.
At the age when he was 15 and experiencing homelessness. And I just, I don't know, that part of the story, you know, everyone here knows, and if you don't know, you should know, sex history and the history of prostitution and sex work is like my bread and butter. I love it so much. And I think it's because of stories like this, because these women understand what it's like to be the outcast and be thrown out by all of society.
Yeah.
And so they naturally, they see a struggling 15-year-old and they're like, we're going to hire you to play the piano for us, you know? Yeah. And it's just like, it gives them this, like,
there's a depth to, like, what is often seen as a very, like, shallow perception of a profession. It's written off in one way only. To give those people depth, it does a lot of...
So during this time, from basically when he was a teenager into his late 20s, he has a series of, like, jobs. And it was really just kind of, he talks about it. There's a quote from him that's saying, like, it's not because I was interested in a lot of things. It was because I was interested in making money. So he basically takes whatever job he's able to take. It's also during this time he would meet his future wife, Sally.
Cute.
Yeah. And he would be, he would have three wives throughout his whole life, but Sally would be the one he was married to the longest. So he eventually would find work as a waiter for the North Coast Limited, which was a transcontinental train. And this provided, like, for the first time, a really consistent source of income. So he's able to marry his wife, Sally, and begin a family with her. However, the train rides would take him away because he would have to, it was like almost working on like a cruise ship. So he would be gone for months at a time.
I forget. It's not like an airline where it's like, oh, you're a stewardess and you make it there and back over a couple of days. It's like weeks at a time.
So he was doing this, and while it provided good money, you know, it had to, it's down. Its drawbacks. So one of the things he would use to pass the time is the people who would come on the train and he would wait for would often bring magazines, because what else are you gonna do on a train, you
yeah
know? it's the 1930s and, you know, magazines are all the rage, and you're on this fancy train, you're passing time, you're going across country. And these magazines that guests would bring on is what would introduce Parks to photography. I'm sure he had seen pictures before, obviously, but it was for the first time that he was able to see pictures that documented, like, kind of documentary style photography. And it was for the first time that he really connected with the art form and saw the power and, like, what could come of it. Specifically, he found, or he saw the works of photographers for the Farm Security Administration, the FSS S.A. Works such as those by Dorothea Lange.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. And those inspired him. And so he comes back to St. Paul and he buys his first camera. Actually, no, he doesn't buy it. It was when they stopped the train in Seattle, Washington at a pawn shop. He buys his first camera. And he is completely self-taught and he like is going to buy this camera to do this. There's actually a quote in his biography that says, quote, "I bought that Vaughtlander Brilliant at a Seattle pawn shop. It wasn't much of a camera, but for only $750, I had purchased a weapon I hope to use against a warped past in an uncertain future." Yeah.
That is a baller line.
I know. This guy, I mean, but I just have so much respect for him.
Yeah, and to teach yourself that, because, like, it's not, like, a point-and-shoot thing. Like, there is no, like, autofocus and, like,
yeah, tuning. Right. Like, it's a little bit more skilled, like, that goes into merit. Photography. Yeah. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And so he teaches himself how to take pictures. Back in St. Paul, the photography clerks who developed his first roll of film, like, his first one, mm-hmm. they were like, dude, this is your first one. Like, you have this natural talent for it. And he really did. And this is where I really encourage everyone to go look at Gordon Park's photography, because it is stunning. Stunning.
BRB.
Oh, my God. And they actually, the clerks at the photography development, the lab, encouraged him to, like, hey, you need to go further with this. And so he sought out basically a way to take, like, actually and be, like, paid for pictures. And one of the ways to do this was fashion photography. He approached a women's clothing store in St. Paul and said, hey, do you want me to take pictures for your advertising? And so he did. And as the story goes, he does this whole photo shoot for him. And after he's developing the pictures, he realizes, oh, no, all but one of the pictures were double exposed. And so he, like, kind of risks it all. And he uses this one usable photograph and he blows it up super big and it works. And this picture caught the eye of Marva Lewis, who is the wife of the heavyweight boxing champion Joe Lewis. And she is very well connected to a lot of other women of means. And she is like, I want you to take my portrait. And then I also want you to take all of my friends' portraits. So she is the one that convinces him to leave St. Paul and move to Chicago in 1940. And this is where he begins his portrait business. And, like, he is taking pictures of society women, and they're able to pay him, like, and this is, like, income that he has not seen before.
These are incredible.
Aren't they?
I feel like he's doing, like, unposed, like, expose photography in a way that wasn't seen.
Yeah. Oh, my God. They are, like,
this doesn't look like something I would gorgeous. Expect in the
20s. So, one of his most famous pictures is, you've probably seen it before, but it's called American Gothic, but it's based off the painting. It's with a janitor with a broom and a mop
in front of the American flag.
Yeah.
That's him.
Another one that you will know is the picture. It's color, which he didn't do color a lot because he liked black and white. Yep.
This one? I had never seen this one before. This is one, the one first one.
You had never seen that one before? That one to me is, like, that's the one by him I recognized. It's, if you know it, it's of...
Colored entrance.
Yeah, colored entrance. It's a mom and her daughter, or what you can presume to be a mom and her daughter. And it's often used, I've seen it used, and when a lot of people say that, like, hey, they intentionally make segregation photos black and white to, like, give us the illusion that, like, it was so long ago.
Yeah.
That's the picture I see them use. Like, look at this one. It's of two, it's a mom, a black mom and a black daughter standing, underneath a sign that says colored entrance. It's like a neon sign, and it's striking how, like, modern it looks. And that's why a lot of people bring it up as like an example of, like, they intentionally use black and white pictures to make us think that it was so long ago.
Yeah. I haven't looked at that American Gothic one in a while.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So I'll talk a little bit about that one, in just a minute here. So his portrait business is, like, is booming. He gains enough of a name of himself for, him to eventually receive the Julius Rosenwald Fellowship in which paid him $200 a month and also offered him his choice of employer. And what this would basically enable him to do is like, go tell us where you want to take pictures, who you want to take pictures for, mm-hmm. and we will send you there and we'll pay you to do it. And he's like, okay, I want to go take pictures for the SFA or the
FSA.
Yeah. The Farm Security Administration, because that was his original.
Anywhere in the world. And he's just,
And I should say too, like, while he's in Chicago, he's doing these like society portraits, but he's also documenting like the struggle of like poor Black people in Chicago at the time.
It's kind
and
of
he's doing
mix.
Yeah. And this is like a theme we see throughout his life, is he does really, really, really high level famous like portrait photography, but he never loses that that like documentary photography, mm-hmm. that like he does both. And it's so fascinating to see him do both. And he is so successful at both. So he's like, I want to go to DC and I want to work for the Farm Security Administration. And so he does. They send him to DC and he works for the FSA under Roy Stryker. And it is during this time that he produces his probably best known or most famous photograph in his like just couple first weeks there, mm-hmm. at the I keep doing it because the FSA, school, yeah. Stephen F. Austin is a school here, FSA, which he titles American Gothic. And it shows a Black woman whose name is Ella Watson, who worked as a janitor for the FSA building. In front of an American flag, holding a broom in one hand and a mop in another hand. And Parks himself said that he had been inspired to create this image because he was kind of expecting DC to be this like pinnacle of like equality. And when he got there, it wasn't that. And so his like, it was a pretty jarring experience to see that like the America's capital is still this like dichotomy and they're still treating me this way. Yeah. So he framed that picture like that. And apparently upon viewing the photograph, his boss Stryker was like, this is an indictment of America, and he's, if anyone sees this, all of my photographers are gonna get fired. So he essentially banned it from ever being published. And it wasn't until years later that I think it was like his work got sent to some archive, and the archive was the one who saw it and published it. Yeah. So Parks actually continues working with the woman in the photograph, Watson, and documents her daily life in a series of photographs, because his kind of work while he was part of the FSA is to, like, again, document the poverty, mm-hmm. and what it's like to live in poverty. And so I enjoy that, like, he expanded on his relationship with her, and not just like left her for this one picture and then just kind of dumped her. So while he was there, the FSA was disbanded, and so he remained in Washington, D.C., and he actually became a correspondent with the Office of War Information, because we are now firmly in World War II territory. It's the early 40s. And during this, he actually was tasked with photographing the all-Black 332nd Fighter Group, which was the Tuskegee Airmen. Yep.
Oh, my God.
Yep. So he is able to photograph them stateside. However, since the war is segregated, and like because of the segregation, mm-hmm. he wasn't allowed to follow the group overseas. And so he resigned from the OWI. And then in 44, he actually does this like brief stint with the Standard Oil Photography Project in New York, where he and his old boss Stryker basically were assigned to take pictures of small towns as a propaganda campaign for the Standard Oil Company, being like, look at all the good that oil has done. Mm-hmm. And again, this is just like, he was just looking for a job, right?
Right.
Around the same time, he was also a freelance photography for the Glamour and Ebony magazines, because he was just kind of freelancing all over the place and doing pictures for whatever he could do them. Mm-hmm. And it's also at this time where he kind of leans into his other photography entrance, because in the magazines that guests would bring on the train, it wasn't just like photojournalist magazines. It was also fashion magazines. And he begins to take freelance photography for Vogue magazine.
For like the Vogue magazine.
Yes, and he became like a part of his work was fashion photography, like not an insignificant, like I'd say like 60-40 like split. Wow. He did a lot of fashion photography, and he works for Vogue for a number of years, and he develops a really unique style, and they really like working with him because kind of before him, models were like wearing clothes were just kind of statically shot, just standing there taking the foot.
It was
like
the
pictures,
clothing, not the aesthetic of the photo.
Yes, but he kind of revolutionized that, and I'm sure you saw some of his pictures when his fashion pictures in that. Because he really emphasized the look of models in motion rather than static poses. And one of the podcasts I was listening to said that when he was doing this, he talks about it in his autobiography, where he is like, the hardest part of the job was getting the models to loosen up.
Because
they were so used to just, you know, standing there and having their picture taken. And so he has some really gorgeous, 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 like, it's like almost like street fashion style photography.
That's what kind of struck me. Yeah. It almost threw me off. He looked almost like newer photography than I would have expected in the
1920s. Yeah. Oh my God. It's gorgeous. Like, you know, me and my coffee table book obsession.
Oh, I would have a coffee table book.
Oh,
with that.
He is my next. He's the next one on my list. I will be keeping an eye out for Gordon Parks photography.
Heck yeah. Honestly, I do feel like it needs to be noted too that like if you Google his images, you get like those Vogue ones next to like
next
low
to his
income,
and that is like how like that's how his career was, and that is actually great because the next point I was going to talk about was there's a quote from him where he talks about like it was striking because I would go to a photo shoot in the afternoon and the color red of the dress was the same as the blood I had seen earlier that day, and it was like, oh my God, this guy was. I just have so much respect for him.
And to not like sell out.
Yeah.
And to not like compromise what you
still
want to bring attention to is huge.
Yeah. Yeah. And then later on in his life, people, when they ask like why, you know, he kind of got some criticism because fashion photography is still a very white space. And so, especially in the 60s, as like civil rights leaders and stuff were coming up, they actually criticized him. They're like, well, you're focusing on fashion or like white people. Why shouldn't you? And he's like, I've done my time in both sides of it. Mm-hmm. I've done 10 years plus of photojournalism that has brought attention to the plight of African Americans. I have done 10 years plus of the fashion world.
Well, and there's something too to be said for like when you're in artistic spaces, it doesn't have to be selling out. It can be like, hey, I'm going to garner attention and fund myself with this higher end stuff and get attention. And you know what? That's going to bring attention to my other work.
Exactly. And let me tell you, he does it because he becomes like the photographer. Like he's not just the best black man photographer. He's like the best photographer, period. He is so incredibly talented. And again, this man is self-taught. Self-taught.
There's some things that you just have to have an eye for. And so many people don't think that photography is an art, but you can see the artists versus like the people who taught that, like who like went to like seminars and classes, but some people just have a knack for it.
Yes. And he genuinely does.
And to break the boundaries too of like, hey, we're not shooting static. We're not shooting, like to like
think outside of
the industry.
Yeah. And it takes that self-taught sometimes. It takes that person who hasn't gone through the traditional schooling to, and has learned all the rules. Cause he doesn't even know the rules to break them. Yeah. He just is, this is a good picture.
I like the way this
and
looks.
It is. Yeah. So in 1948, he writes and takes photographs for a photographic essay on a young Harlem gang leader, and he submits it to Vogue Life. He submits it to Life magazine, and this is such a revolutionary piece that it lands him a full-time staff job at Life magazine, which is like the top magazine in America at the time.
If you can shoot for anything, it's Nat Geo or Life.
Yep. And he lands a job at Life, and he is a staff photographer and is on staff at Life for until the 70s, like for 20 years.
That's a
he
long
is
time.
There during his 20-year-long career with Life magazine. He would become, quote, one of the most provocative and celebrated photojournalists in the United States. His work included images of Harlem, of course, because that's where he lived, and after the Harlem Gang essay, he kind of like always had a connection with that space. He photographed the Black Panthers, the civil rights movement. Apparently there was this very scandalous Ingrid Bergman, Roberto Rossellini love affair that he was able to actually get like the pictures for, because that's how much he was known and trusted. He took pictures of Malcolm X, Stokely Carmichael, Muhammad Ali, and Barbara Streisand, and like so much more. He was prolific. He was the top photographer at Life magazine, the top photo magazine of the 1900s.
These photos are jarring.
Yes.
I could scroll through these for days.
I, like, oh my God. I have, he is, oh my yes. God. He is,
guys,
so
please, like, even if you're
incredibly
driving, like,
talented.
Look these up.
Oh my God. I know.
These are, like, it's almost like I don't expect photo quality to be this capable.
I know.
From this time.
I know. Because, and it's so, they're so crisp and sharp, and they tell such a story.
And there is color photography.
Yeah,
here.
And he does. So he does do color photography, but he opts to choose most of them in black and, to shoot mm-hmm. in black and white, because like the photojournalist style is you kind of have to like take it in the moment.
Yeah.
And black and white is a little bit more forgiving to like imperfections.
Yes.
And that's why he mainly does that. But, so, yeah, so he's doing he's the it. Damn thing, and he is, yeah, he, I'll get into it a little bit more later, but, like, he is one of the people that, like, their legacy and, like, accolade section of the Wikipedia page
it's
is, like,
long.
Half of it.
Yeah.
Because I was getting towards the end of his life, and I was like, what's all this space left at the bottom?
It's like, oh, it's yeah. just raw awards.
Yes. So this is one of them. In 1960, he was named Photographer of the Year by the American Society of Magazine Photographers. And, it, like, I can't impress upon you for Life and for Vogue, like, the incredible work that he has done in fashion photography and in photojournalism. Like, it is...
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Well, I feel like, especially for something like Vogue, I'm sure this is part of what shoots them to the forefront.
I'm
of
sure.
The,
yes.
Of, like, fashion, yeah. is the yeah. ability to consume Vogue photographs in yeah. a new way. They're doing something... Not
different
with their,
that no one's done yeah. before. Yeah.
There's a lot of people doing avant-garde fashion.
Mm-hmm.
There's no one else photographing fashion
right.
like that. And
yeah.
that makes it interesting to look at.
Exactly. So, and photography is not his only artistic pursuit.
Of course it's not.
If you remember from the beginning of the episode, he is also does music. And he does. He composed film scores, orchestral music.
No, he did
and
not.
He writes the ballet called Martin, which was a ballet about the life of Martin Luther King Jr. He composed the music for that ballet. And then he gets involved in Hollywood. And starting in the 50s, he works as a consultant for various Hollywood productions. He would later direct a series of documentaries on Black poor life that were commissioned by the National Education of Television. And in 1969, he becomes the first African-American to direct a major Hollywood motion picture with the Steven Brothers studio, Warner Brothers studio, based on the film adaptation of his semi-autobiographical novel called The Learning Tree that he had published in 1963. Because, of course, he writes books, too.
Yeah. this is, like, the epitome of Jack of all trades.
Yes.
Like, some people are born with art in their veins.
Yes, and he is absolutely one of them. So The Learning Tree was about his experience growing up in rural Kansas and kind of the fine line that segregation took form in a society or in a small town like he had, where they had to kind of coexist, but it was a very tense coexistence.
Yeah.
So he writes a screenplay and composed the musical score for that film along with directing it. And he wasn't the only composer. He worked with Henry Brandt, who was a friend of his. But this was his first, but by no means his most famous, because his next studio production film was one of the biggest box office hits of 1971 when it was released.
You're going to hit something insane.
Inspires a whole genre of films, aka the blaxploitation drama or genre. He's the director of Shaft.
What?
Yes. He directs Shaft. Yeah. You guys should see the look on Kat's face. This guy was insane. Why have I not heard of him?
Because, I mean, we know racism. Why.
Yeah. But, like.
Oh, my God.
My God, right?
Oh, my God.
Shaft. Yeah. And I'm like, damn, I've got to see it now. I've never seen it.
It's one of those things that you hear about your whole life.
You know Shaft. Everyone knows Shaft.
But.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah.
Musical scores, directing, photography, like.
Writing.
To be that talented.
I cannot imagine. He directs the film sequel, Shaft's Big Score. And again, this is like a whole genre is kind of birthed with Shaft.
Yeah.
There's a lot to be said about that genre, but nonetheless, it's still a genre.
Yeah.
He actually, because, like, filmmaking wasn't his, like, kind of main love, you could say, mm-hmm. he kind of switches between, like, do I want to do these big studio products or, like, projects mm-hmm. just to make money, or do I want to do something more artistic? And he ultimately decides to stick with more artistic things, and he doesn't end up doing a lot more movies. He directs one called The Super Cops in 1974, and then Lead Belly, which he actually cites as his favorite film that he directs, which is a biographical film of the blues musician Huddy Ledbetter.
Okay.
And little fun fact, in 2000s, when they remake Shaft starring Samuel L. Jackson, he has a little cameo in it, which I think is fun.
Does he really?
Yes. Yeah.
I love that. I love it when people do that.
Yeah. So that's kind of like, he continues taking photos and doing all of that through as long as he is able to into the 80s and the 90s. His like personal life side, as I mentioned, he would have three wives, and with those three wives, he would have four children. His oldest son, Gordon Parks Jr., actually took after him a lot, and he directs the film Superfly, which is a very, very famous and critically acclaimed film. It probably was better than Shaft, a lot of people say, but like Shaft got credit because it was the first, but Superfly is like the better movie. Gordon Parks, unfortunately, was only able to direct one film because he was actually scouting locations in 1979 for his next film and died in a helicopter crash. Yeah. So one of the podcasts I was listening to talked about how, like, apparently Parks had talked about how he and his son had a little bit of a competition of, like, who could be the better filmmaker, who would make the better movie. And so after his son passed, he just kind of lost his love for movies because he associated obviously with his son.
I can totally see why you wouldn't want to keep doing that, but that's so sad.
So his last relationship that we know of was with none other than Gloria Vanderbilt, and they were
Vanderbilt with
Gloria Vanderbilt. Yep.
Okay.
And they were together up until his passing in 2006 at the age of 93 from cancer. And he is buried in his hometown of Fort Scott, Kansas. And again, he has an incredibly long legacy section and awards and everything he has won that he's won throughout the years. But here are some that I kind of like. Here's his selected.
From what you can discern, the most prominent.
Yes. So director Spike Lee cites Parks as an inspiration, saying, quote, "You get inspiration where it comes from. It doesn't have to be because I'm looking at his films. The odds that he got these films made under when there were no black directors is enough." He is actually referenced in Kendrick Lamar's music video for Element, where they transform some of his pictures into moving kind of little vignette scenes. His work is kept in many, many archives throughout the country, including Library of Congress, the Gordon Parks Museum/Center in Fort Scott, Kansas, the National Archives, and the Smithsonian Institution. He went on to receive more than 20 honorary doctorates in his lifetime.
What?
Yes.
20.
20.
Good Lord.
Yes.
This kid
that got told, don't bother trying to go to college, gets 20 honorary doctorates.
In your words.
Yep. In 2000, the Library of Congress awarded him its accolade, the Living Legend Award, which honors, quote, artists, writers, activists, filmmakers, physicians, entertainers, sports figures, and public servants who have made significant contributions to Americans' diverse cultural, scientific, and social heritage. So really, really big thing for him. He receives in 2003 the Royal Photographic Society's special 150th anniversary medal, an honorary fellowship in recognition of a sustained significant contribution to the art of photography. So that, yes. He also receives in 2000 the Congress of Racial Equality's Lifetime Achievement Award. And most significantly to me, the Sesame Street character Gordon was named after him.
Was it really?
Yes. Yep. And that is,
wow,
Gordon Parks.
I can genuinely say that I don't think I've, I don't think yet that you've brought anyone forward that I should have known so well and
oh my God.
As this.
I know. It would be like him and Bayard Rustin would be the two that I'm like, why the fuck did I not know about these people?
Yeah. Well, like, it's like, because there's plenty of people that you brought forward, like the Chinese pirate queen.
Right. That like, that's like, fun. Yeah. But there's no reason why I should know about her.
It's ancient enough history that, like, if it got overlooked, like, in my education, I understand why. But in an age when we're trying to put such an emphasis, like, on this, like, there is no reason I shouldn't know this person. Because I know his work.
I know.
Like, obviously, I know his work. I've seen some of his
photographs. Yeah, you've seen his pictures.
To, like, not know the name and the breadth of his work is
insane.
I know.
It's insane. And I just, like I said, he's my next coffee book hunt, because to just be able to like hold and look at his pictures would be, or like to, I keep an eye out for like an exhibition of his, because I would love to be able to see his photographs in a way that they deserve to be seen and not just like on Google images, you know?
God, no.
Yeah. So
that's true. I didn't think about that. I was like, can you imagine being in a room of like high def brands? Oh, it'd be amazing.
Yeah. So cannot believe I had not heard of him before, and I really, really, really enjoyed learning about him, and I hope everyone else did too.
I definitely did, and if you didn't like get the visual aid at some point, I highly encourage it, because oh my gosh, those were beautiful photos.
Just look up Gordon Parks pictures. They are, it's so worth it. It's so
those
worth
beautiful.
It.
Those yeah, were incredible. And like you said, I think it's like a there's that jarring like, oh, like that's a color photo of segregation.
Yeah,
like yeah. You know, we don't get to consume media because of reasons on, you know, to this point, like to get to see those side by side. And they're all kind of mixed together in the Google search, too. So you'll get a bit of both.
Yeah. And you do really get the full breadth of what he did. Yeah. And so.
Wow. Fantastic job.
Thank you. Thank you.
Wow. I'm glad we had two pretty big topics today.
Yeah. Yeah. I think they were good, though.
That's awesome. Yeah. No. I don't know if we can top it again next week. We have to record next week's right after this. Yeah. I'm going to be like coming off this high.
I know.
But we'll try. We'll bring you something good next week. And until then, you know, you can always tweet at us at TINAHL podcast.
Or you can email us at thisisnotahistorylecture@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm. We're going to be pre-recording a couple weeks ahead from here on out because we have a lot going on in the spring. These things always do.
Yeah.
So we're kind of mitigating that. But even if we don't get it, like your topic covered in the next week or so, it we'll put it on our list, and you always just let us know.
Yeah, for sure. We appreciate you listening to us, and we'll catch you next week.
Next week, and you'll also get to find out next week why this is not
a history
lecture.
Bye.